From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week via Skype are VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb and VOA U.S. politics and policy reporter Vero Balderas. Welcome, Carla and Vero.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, here are the issues. Fresh off his dramatic visit to Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, President Joe Biden met with NATO allies in Warsaw, Poland, to highlight how the U.S. has unified NATO and the West in providing support to Ukraine. The president announced $500 million in new U.S. aid, including artillery, ammunition, and anti-tank weapons. Biden and NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg attended the summit of the Bucharest Nine, countries on NATO's easternmost flank. The aim is to enhance cooperation among NATO's newest members to support the alliance's objectives of improving security and stability between the Baltic and Black Seas. Georgia politicians and officials paid tribute to former President Jimmy Carter, who was in home hospice care. His accomplishments at both the national level and within Georgia's communities are being remembered on both sides of the political aisle. First Lady Jill Biden makes her first visit to Africa in her official role. She is visiting Namibia and Kenya, where she will focus on women's empowerment, children's issues, and food insecurity that has ravaged parts of the continent. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. First, let's go back to Biden's bold and surreal visit to Kyiv, an active war zone. Carla, from a journalist's perspective, what was going through your mind when this trip came to light?
This was a very brave thing for the president to do. Let's keep in mind that this is an active war zone, but unlike some of the visits in the past by previous presidents to active war zones, there aren't any U.S. soldiers in this war zone. Think of Afghanistan, think of Iraq. There was a huge defensive presence. So when he came in with the firepower, so to speak. This time, I mean, President Biden came in via train. They did let Russia know in advance, just briefly in advance, a couple hours in advance, basically to warn Russia not to do anything while the president was there, essentially. But there was a real threat. Russia is still daily targeting the Ukrainian people with tanks on the ground, with missiles in the sky. There were air sirens going off, as we heard, while the president was there. This was a very historic moment. I think that President Volodymyr Zelensky even called it a historic moment because they were able to talk face-to-face in Kyiv about what was happening on the battlefield.
Yeah, I think it was also very important to lift the morale of the people of Kyiv and Ukraine in general. We have all seen the resilience of the government and the people. I've interviewed some families that were living in the Donbas area when the conflict started several years ago, and then they had to move to Kyiv seeking protection, seeking shelter. And when I interviewed them in Kyiv, they weren't expecting the war that Russia was threatening to actually happen. So the psychological impact of these human beings constantly being bombarded by these threats and then actually seeing their cities being attacked has been very damaging. And in fact, UNICEF has warned of the psychological impact on children and how important it is to have democratic leader, the United States president on the ground, kind of supporting not only those efforts by the government, but the courage of the Ukrainians, of the citizens, regular citizens that are trying to survive. I think a key message and a reminder that this conflict is not just about the survival of Ukraine, it's about the survival of democracy around the world.
Oh, yes, I definitely think that that was the major message that the president was coming with. Solidarity. You heard him in Kyiv say, democracy stands. That message is not only getting through across the globe, it is reaching the front lines. I mean, I was just watching some reporting where a reporter was interviewing someone on the front lines and they said, you know, why are you fighting? And they said, we're fighting for our country, but we're fighting for democracy. This is the difference between an autocracy and democracy, something that Biden has said repeatedly. So it's not just a message. It is an indoctrination. It is an essence of what Ukrainians are doing. And they truly believe that they are fighting for everyone at this point.
And there's, you know, reporting by our Ukrainian colleague, Tatiana Vorosko, that I would invite people to read on our website, voanews.com, because she actually interviewed several experts on how at the very beginning there was this questioning of how long will the Ukrainian government and the people on the ground be able to really push back on these attacks by Russia. And there was a lot of hesitancy on the part of how much should we really invest in this war? Are they going to lose it in the first months? And there was a lot of speculation on whether the support would actually start diminishing. In the beginning, people were thinking that Russia, with the military might, would be able to take over in a few days. And Western analysts, as Tatiana was pointing out, didn't really account for the reform of the Ukrainian army since 2013. So they were thinking that Ukraine, at many levels, didn't have the capacity to stand and to really confront these attacks by Russia. However, different analysts are saying they do have a very specific way of managing and of making sure that the military is unified, that the morale is high, that they have a clear plan, which is something that Russia hasn't actually been able to put together yet.
Very nice perspective on this. And President Biden also announced $500 million in new U.S. aid, including artillery, ammunition, and anti-tank weapons. Carla, how is this money being used in Ukraine?
I'm glad you brought up this aid package because, honestly, this is not the most interesting aid package that we've received. There's no big item like the Patriot that we've had in some of these or the Abrams tanks that have been announced in some of these aid packages. But this package is quite important because it is basically replenishing all of the systems that the Ukrainians have been using incredibly effectively. There's additional ammunition for the HIMARS. Those are the rocket systems that can launch up to 35 miles, 80, 90 kilometers into territory that Russia has. And those have been incredibly effective and have given the Ukrainians the ability to push the Russians back, so much so that there are actually children, little boys named HIMARS in Ukraine because it has made such a difference on the battlefield and protected a lot of people. There's more artillery rounds. There's more Bradley vehicles. Those are those weaponized vehicles that the Ukrainians are expecting to get pretty soon. Officials tell me that, you know, they're not there yet, that they should be there very soon. The Ukrainians actually just finished their training on the Bradleys days ago. So we should see how effective they are going to be in the fight. And this is important to get them in the fight as soon as possible because we already see Russia putting in more troops into Ukraine for an offensive. Some people say that it's already beginning to start this new offensive. And so the West is really trying to get the Ukrainians as prepared as possible. Let me point out, it's not just the United States. Yes, this was a massive aid package for the United States to give the Ukrainians, but there have also been a lot of the Eastern European nations that have provided a lot of funds as well. Poland has given German Leopard 2 tanks, and Britain has given their Challenger 2 tanks. I was speaking to a major from Britain, and he was a tanker, and he was explaining to me how the Challengers may not be the fastest, but they can take a hit. They're really heavily armored, much more so than the Soviet era tanks that the Ukrainians are currently losing in the battlefield and currently using in the battlefield. So he said, you know, with these Challengers, with these Leopards, they will be able to take a hit and keep going into the fight while the Soviets will take hits and then be done. And so we will see if that plays out on the battlefield. But he was very hopeful that as soon as the Ukrainians could get these tanks in, that a difference could be made.
And I think in the same context of how it is very important to work with European partners, definitely the United States has always emphasized that collaboration is key. And one of the groups, the so-called Ukraine Defense Contact Group, is a coalition of 50 partner nations, and they have actually committed $50 billion in security assistance. And that includes 700 tanks and thousands of other armored vehicles, more than 1,000 artillery systems, more than 2 million rounds of artillery ammunition, And all that equipment is going to hopefully support the Ukrainians.
I was just in Eastern Europe and I spoke with Estonia's defense minister about that very topic. And he was concerned whether or not the tanks would get there in time, because it's not just about getting the tanks into the fight. So when you use something like a tank, you have people that man that tank, but they're used in a group. You know, they have to learn how to do the formations. They have to learn how to get the tanks where they need to go without them running over mines. There's a lot more to a tank than just learning how to drive it and shoot it. Absolutely. It's a team effort, and it takes a lot of time to train. And that was something that the Estonian defense minister told me he was very concerned about. But let's not forget, President Joe Biden met with the Bucharest Nine, and those are Eastern European nations that are very concerned about what's going on in Ukraine. They look at what's going on in Ukraine, and they say, we could be next. Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, the three Baltic nations, border Russia. And Estonia's defense minister was telling me, we know that every Russian tank that's lost on the battlefield in Ukraine is one less tank behind our borders. And that's why Estonia has thrown in a ton of support to Ukraine. They've given them all of their 155 millimeter howitzers, because they said that the U.S. has come in with HIMARS to help fill that gap and improve that defensive capability for them until they can get their own HIMARS, which are expected to arrive in 2024 or 2025. So, you know, there's a lot of criticism in the United States. I was just watching a television anchor say, why is the United States providing all of the money? They're not. Yes, the United States is providing a massive amount of aid, absolutely. But Estonia has given 1% of its entire GDP just to support Ukraine, 3% of its GDP for its own self-defense since this war broke out. Latvia, the same thing, another 1% of its entire GDP to support Ukraine in this war. So these countries along the eastern flank are very, very concerned. They see what's happening. They see that Russia has not given up. They know that this is going to be something that they need to be in for the long haul. And that's why they're providing this aid. And that's why they're welcoming U.S. and other NATO allies coming in and beefing up their defenses. And that was the focus of my reporting while I was in Eastern Europe. I was able to meet with the closest U.S. troops to Russia's border in Estonia. I was able to meet with some troops that were helping to teach Estonians how to use the HIMARS. So as soon as they got those, they would be ready to use them. I was able to see a lot of NATO countries, not just the US, UK, France, the Danes, were all training with the Estonians on how to integrate should somebody invade their territory. And then I was down in Romania also, where I was watching soldiers from the 101st looking across the border into Ukraine and learning from the lessons on the battlefield and adapting their training accordingly while they were also improving the Romanians. So I know that Putin wanted to make sure that Ukraine was never a part of NATO, but if he's done anything, he's united NATO and he's made Ukraine want to join NATO and join the West even more so.
Because you were in Romania, Carla, I kind of want to ask you if some reports about the Romanian population not necessarily supporting the support that Ukraine is getting. I was hearing that there are some concerns that half of the population is, yes, let's support Ukraine, and the other half is kind of, maybe not. So what did you see on the ground?
What I saw on the ground for me was definitely a united front for the military. I spent most of my time with the military there, but we did take a train into Constanța. There was a 3-hour trip to get there, but it's one of those things where I'm not aware of what the population as a whole is feeling, but the military definitely welcomed the United States support there. In Romania, the number of troops have tripled from the United States. They had about 1,000 in Romania in January of last year. Now there are 3,000 U.S. soldiers in Romania, so a massive increase there. And it's not just the U.S. There was an Italian Air Force unit that's part of the NATO Enhanced Air Policing Team there in Romania. They help patrol the skies for Romanians, because the way that NATO views this, it's not a country-by-country defense. NATO, they consider as one entire entity.
Well, it's time now for a quick break, and when we return, Jill Biden embarks on her first visit to Africa as the U.S. First Lady. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issues. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two, then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype, VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb and VOA U.S. politics and policy reporter Vero Balderas. Well, Jill Biden is visiting the continent of Africa for the first time as U.S. First Lady, making stops in Namibia and Kenya. With this visit to Namibia, Biden also becomes the first U.S. First Lady to visit the country since the Southwest country gained independence in 1990. Vera, what kind of an impact is expected from her visit?
Well, this visit is building on last year's Africa Leaders Summit, and it's another way of the Biden administration to show that Africa is critical when it comes to advancing the shared global priorities, as they put it, from trade, economics, cybersecurity, and technology. And she's always promoting women empowerment, the health of children. She obviously, as a teacher herself, she wants to make sure that young democracies in Africa specifically, you know that there is a way forward when everybody has equality, when everybody has access to food security. That's one of the most important messages, I think, of this trip of the First Lady. And it's also a way to demonstrate to other superpowers, China, that has also an eye on Africa, to say, hey, we're here and we want democracy to prevail. We want to give these young governments the possibility of a better way forward. And this is going to help us in the West as well.
And I'd like to point out that let's not forget there are about 1.4 billion people living in Africa. It's about 18% of the population, but only 3% of the globe's economic output. So there's a lot of potential in Africa for the people to grow, for the people to be able to aspire to have more wealth. The United States has been looking at Africa and watching China try to come in and take resources and try to influence Africa as well. And I think that the battle looking forward, whether it's economically, politically, possibly even militarily, will be for influence in Africa. And so this is a very good sign that Jill Biden is going to visit Africa to make sure that the United States is on the hearts and minds of many Africans.
And at the same time, I think it's important to point out that the United States also wants to make sure that it's not interfering in local politics. For instance, with the peace accord in Nigeria that was signed by political parties and candidates running in the presidential election on February the 25th, I mean, the United States made it very clear that it does not support a single candidate or party, but a peaceful and transparent, as they put it, process that reflect the will of the people of Nigeria. So I think the First Lady is going to also emphasize that the United States is not there to just say, hey, you have to live the way that we live, otherwise we're not going to support you. It's rather finding their own way forward and making sure that they have the support of the United States.
I want to briefly turn our attention to former U.S. President Jimmy Carter. The 98-year-old Democrat, who was the 39th president, is in home hospice care. This week, he was honored by the Georgia Senate and the Georgia House of Representatives for his life of public service and advocacy for human rights. In addition, diplomacy has been a large part of Carter's post-presidency life. He worked with numerous U.S. presidents on various foreign and domestic policies. And I believe his legacy will be the tireless humanitarian work that he has done after his presidency. Your thoughts on Carter's legacy?
Absolutely, Kim. No, I completely agree with you there. There are people that can definitely agree to disagree on what they felt about Carter's presidency. Clearly, he was a one-term president, so there was a lot of disagreeing among Americans during that time. But like you said, it's his life after the presidency that really, really showed the type of person that Jimmy Carter was. And I think he will be remembered for the 2002 Nobel Peace Prize award that he got for pushing peace across the globe during his presidency. And one of the highlights of his presidency was the 1978 Camp David Accords. That was central to his legacy going forward. And I think that his focus on peace through the Carter Center that he founded with his wife has really been central in everything he does, whether it's helping build houses for Habitat for Humanity, something he did years and years because he understood that housing is so critical to safety for not just Americans, but people all across the globe. I think that is what not only American citizens, but the globe will hold on to.
Also, I think it's a time to reflect on what makes a president great. What are the standards that we use to actually say that was a good president? And there are different surveys. The C-SPAN conducted surveys in 2009, 2021, and you can see the ranking of presidents. But it's basically how their moral commitments are the ones that speak very loudly to whether or not the society sees presidents as good. And as you were mentioning, Carla, the Habitat for Humanity has been one of the ways in which the Carter family and former president will have shown commitment to help those in need, regardless of the political achievements and the challenges that he faced. I think it's a time to reflect on what he did for the United States, not only in the domestic field, but also what the message he brought to the world about the United States, the example that he gave. I think that's something that people are reflecting on.
And it didn't matter which side of the aisle was in the White House at the time. I remember in 2018, he wrote a letter to President Donald Trump, a Republican, saying that he'd be willing to go to North Korea and advocate on the United States' behalf. I mean, that was just what he wanted to do. He wanted to help America. And I think it's especially post-presidency, it didn't matter if it was a Democrat in charge or a Republican in charge. It was America that needed helping. And I must point out that I think that President Biden is going to be really hurt by this loss. I don't know if you guys realize this, but Biden was actually one of the first U.S. senators to endorse Carter back in the 70s when he made his presidential run. Biden has continued to be mentored by Carter in these years. I think that this is going to be a huge loss for our president.
And he has actually tweeted, I'm quoting him, "To our friends, Jimmy and Rosalind, and to their family, Jill and I are with you in prayer and send you our love."
Well, it's time now to find out what is weighing on the minds of our panelists. Vero, what is weighing on your mind this week?
Well, with all this talk about support to Ukraine, one of the largest, if not the largest, homeless encampment in the U.S. Capitol was cleared by the authorities, who are trying to find ways to deal with the crisis of homelessness in the United States. And some of the comments that I received on my reporting on social media were, how come the U.S. is supporting other countries and they cannot solve this issue and help homeless people? Well, it's a big challenge. 600,000 people were homeless in the United States, according to some estimates, last year. It's just the lack of case management workers. There are plans by the Biden administration, by the local District of Columbia government, to try to tackle the problem. But the reality is there needs to be a holistic approach with mental health, with affordable housing, with resources to help people stay employed. And so this is what's kind of in my mind these days, especially with the storm that is going to land in many states in the United States. These people are without shelter. And I think as long as there isn't a solid plan to get them out of homelessness and help them deal with their challenges, this is a problem that will continue in the richest country in the world while it's trying to help other countries.
Thank you. Very important thoughts there. And Carla.
Well, you know, I've been covering Ukraine pretty extensively as the Pentagon correspondent. So my biggest question right now is, what's next for the Pentagon? They have given a lot of weapons to Ukraine, but two weapons that they have not given them are these long range missiles called ATACMS that you can put in these HIMARS, and they can go three times farther than the Gimler missiles that they currently have. So I'm wondering if they're going to give them those weapons anytime soon. VOA was just speaking with the Undersecretary for Policy at the Pentagon, Dr. Colin Call, this week, and he said he wouldn't rule them out, but they weren't being given at the moment. And his reasoning was because Ukraine already has other weapons that they can use to reach those long-range targets. And when VOA pushed him on that, he said, well, for example, they can use drones one way to get to these longer range targets. So it'll be interesting to see if that change happens. So only time will tell if they're going to switch on the TACMs, these long range weapon systems as well, to potentially reach into Crimea and hit Russian targets there.
And we'll close the show on those thoughts. My thanks go to our panelists, VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb and VOA U.S. politics and policy reporter Vero Belderis. I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for listening. Be sure to tune in next week for more Issues in the News.